So there's special cases for the binding gathering phase, which is to do with certain situations when programming. For example, there's this concept of doing forward declarations. So what is a forward declaration? What do we need it for? Well, you can imagine situations where you want to write a subroutine that, for example, wants to recursively call itself. So it needs some way of getting a handle to itself, so to say. And there's also a situation where you have this concept of recursive data structures, where you have to specify the layout of a certain data structure with the help of its own layout. So there's always this notion of recursion involved in that. And in these situations, there's the there was the old-fashioned solution of introducing this kind of a concept like the forward declaration. What does it look like? Well, for example, you might want to program a recursive data structure that mutually has references to the other one. And in these cases, you have to start with one of either of them, for example, with that list zero. So if you start programming this one, we have to refer to the tape for the partner structure, which would be the list one structure, which you want to mention in there. But if we haven't mentioned the type so far in any way, then the compiler doesn't have any type information, so it cannot find whether how to lay out this data at that point. Well, what you would ordinarily do is you would mention the other type beforehand. So let's have a look at the other one. That's the type for list one, and in this case, it's referring to type list zero in this case. So there's no real order that we can maintain between these two, so that there's no dangling references. So the only way to solve that with the axiom that we have to mention or declare a type before we use it somewhere was this kind of compromise, which was this forward declaration. That means that we have to declare the type in some primitive form beforehand, and before we actually specify how it really looks. So we create kind of a template that has to be filled in later on. Yes, please.
Would this really be necessary? Because if we say, okay, we limit this recursive problems to pointers, and we know, okay, a pointer is in has a dimension size, so it's 4 or 8 bytes, and we say, okay, we don't know how this function looks exactly in detail, but we are using only the pointer. Would be that possible?
Yeah, but
you can refer to the elements then.
You always have to cast then, yeah. But in principle, yeah, you can have a kind of semantically equivalent formulation of the same situation, but it doesn't have the same comfort to use. Actually, there's quite a chain of declarations that you can perform in languages like C. You can kind of refine your forward declaration with one declaration after the other. This is often done for methods, for example, where you just start giving the system the method name and just doing two braces afterwards, and later on you refine this prototype for a function with the correct types for the arguments, or with a just a void in the parentheses when you don't want the function to be given without any parameters. And then with a third declaration, you can give the whole thing a body, for example. So there's refinement steps, so to say. So in general, this is under the concept of forward declarations. And yeah, you kind of have to enter a placeholder in your symbol table for that, and either try to check on the fly when the structure is introduced that there's still a few references there that you have to fill in, or you have to do a pass afterwards where you clean up all your open references. But yeah, that's the way how you would deal with that. Yeah, so it's a forward declaration, exactly. Yeah. Same goes for this problem of recursive functions. Well, if you just have a simple recursion like this one here, it's not so much of a problem because it's for most of the languages that we know, we have to specify the name for the method in advance anyway. So it is well known as soon as we parse the body. So all we have to do is we have to enter the name of the method or function in the symbol table as soon as we hit the header of the function, so that we can resolve the recursive occurrence of the name. However, there are also languages where you have to explicitly tell the system to do so, if you think for those let rec data structures or something. Okay. However, there's still this concept of mutual recursion, which you can also apply to methods, where you might have situations like this one. Let's see once again where you have two methods, even and odd, and they call each other in recursion. And for this for these two, you also have to kind of give in advance the name of the method that is referenced from the first defined function. So that's because of the occurrence of this even here. You have something similar for ML, where you also would have to say what this identifier refers to, and you do that with this end element here. Okay, so there's also another concept that's overloading of names. So the identity of, in this case, a method, because when we're talking about overloading, we're in most cases talking about object-oriented languages. Of course, there's also C standards where you can do overloading of names. So probably not only object-oriented languages, but for these types of languages, it's not sufficient to just only look at the function name in isolation, but rather you have to also look at the types of the parameters and probably also the return type in order to decide whether two method or function specifications are actually talking about the same concept of a function, or probably are related in ways like inheritance, like overwriting. For these types finding function identities, you have to resolve also the types of the parameters, and this might be not so trivial, especially when you think of situations where you want to, for example, generate code for a method call. And these in these situations, you want to, first of all, resolve what method is actually meant when you have a certain call expression. And there, for that, you have to resolve the types of the parameters, and then kind of associate the parameter types with correct types of declared methods that actually are compatible with those that are mentioned in the function call. And that's something which is not so trivial. I think we talk about something like that in the programming languages lecture a little bit more in detail. But yeah, there's a lot of resolution, type resolution going on there. And yeah, for many of those, you have to have a more global view on all the sources that have been provided to the compiler in order to decide whether the things that are specified in there are actually correct. In the past, compilers have been written in kind of this single pass style, and this was actually quite a problem for these kind of parsers to make sure that they had all the information from the base class before they went into the type checking for the subclasses. So yeah, that has been non-trivial in the past, but I think this concept of just having a single pass compiler is has been discarded since then. So it's not so much of a problem right now, but yeah, you have to go over the different locations in several passes now. Anyway, once you have the bindings, once you have resolved all the types of the declared things, you can then continue with the next chapters like type checking or type inference. So what is exactly the difference between type checking and type inference? Any idea from the experiences so far?
Yes, Liz. I think type checking just makes sure that the types you declare are correct, that they work. And with type inference, you kind of you do not declare the type, but the compiler tries to guess the type that it should be.
I think in general, that's quite correct. What you said was, just repeat for audience, that the type checking is just about verifying that everything is correct, and type inference would actually produce types for certain elements. And that is certainly true if you talk about the types of variables. So in languages where you have type inference, then you do not declare, at least in non-ambiguous locations, you don't declare types for variables, but you just let them be inferred by the system. However, for composed expressions, for example, then most type checking systems or languages that actually only have type checking also perform analysis on, for example, overloaded operators, in order to make sure that they jump to the right implementation of that, or that they generate the right code for that. For example, if the floating point multiplication versus the integer multiplication, you have to make sure to get the right one with the right operands. So there's a little bit of inference of types also going on for most of the type checking systems, but the if you want to in a more academic way, you have these two contraries. There's this type checking where you only verify, and the type inference where you also come up with new types. Yeah, another special case for our declarations and usages is multiple classes of identifiers. What is that? Well, you have, for example, in C, something like the concept of a variable name. That's quite common. That's something like int I or something. Then I is a variable name, but you might also want to introduce something like this, a type def, where the lexicographic structure of that thing here is the same as the one that we have seen before. However, those two are treated completely differently from the point on where they have been introduced. They are both treated in separate classes. The first one is now in the class of identifiers. The second one is now in the class of type names. So that is the second concept for the same lexicographic group here in C. And there's similar things for other languages. There, for example, for Java, there's the class names, the methods, and the fields, for example. In Haskell, you have type names, constructors, variables, infix variables, and constructors. So there's a whole lot of different classes for things that are essentially pretty similar. And there's languages where there's ways to change the class of such an identifier, and that's something what I've shown you above. This typedef in C acts in exactly that way. When we have such a typedef int I, then during parsing, we get tokens for a keyword, another keyword, and here, what is the token for something like this? Well, that is, at that point, still an identifier. But by specifying this instruction, the concept in C is that I, from now on, now changes its class, and later on, I will just be treated with by a different class, which is then not identifier, but type name, which is another token class altogether. So in order for that to work, there must be some kind of loopback into the very first stages of our compiler to inform the scanner that from now on there these identifiers that match this lexical scheme, just I, letter I, will not be treated as an identifier anymore, but instead as a type name. So that's how it is actually done. The parser has to inform the scanner as soon as it sees the declaration so that the class is changed afterwards. However, that's something that's not as easily done as it sounds in the first place. If you take something like the C grammar from some publication, there's this famous book that introduces the ANSI C standard, and this behavior of type names is worth a single line in this book. And the grammar just has some kind of plain text in the middle where it just says that in certain cases identifiers can also become type names. But why is it such a large problem? Well, I think there's no need for def in there. In the grammar itself, there's a distinction between this token type type name and identifier. However, if you look at code where this is actually specified, then you might have, for example, a code where you at first introduce the new type type name with the typedef struct and the name point T as the name for this type. And then immediately you use this newly introduced type. Probably like this, for the specification of a new variable. From a point of view of the grammar, that looks like this. You have for declarations, you have a list of declaration specifiers. What are these declaration specifiers? Well, that's for once, it's these keywords like static, volatile. There's the type, the different types like void, character. There's another character, interesting. Yeah. Anyway, typedef is also one of these declaration specifiers. So you get your typedef mixed into your declaration specifier somewhere in this list. And after that, we have the declarators, which is the second component of such a declaration. And declarators are, well, there's a little bit more than just identifiers for declarators, but essentially for what is interesting here is that we have the identifiers over here, and then we have the semicolon. Okay, what is the problem now? Well, the general concept that we said was that in case that we hit such a typedef instruction is that we would add the identifier or the lexically matched character sequence for point T would be something that we want to associate with a type name now. And so we have to inform the scanner that we have point T as a type name right now, so we add it to the list of patterns that the scanner should take for deciding whether he would where it would generate an identifier or a type name. And when would we do this? Well, as you might have still in memory, is that the points where we would have callbacks into our parser system was when we have a complete right-hand side and this right-hand side is reduced to its left-hand side, then we get a callback into the parser where we can have user code, and that would be the place for us to insert our code that informs the scanner about a change in this list. So can anyone then think of a way how this could be problematic? Well, if you think of your parser generator algorithms you had or if your parser algorithms in both of the major ways you had the concept of look ahead, and look ahead was something that was telling you about whether you would have to reduce or not. So in case where we have to decide whether we want to reduce this or not, our parser will probably already have issued to the scanner that it needs one more symbol in order to its decision. So what it will actually do is it will additionally also try to get the next symbol, which the parser will which the scanner will decide on being an identifier here. So this will be consumed and cached for later use, all the while our parser will reduce this part of the syntax and tell the scanner to enter point T to be a new type name, and we try to continue parsing. But now, since it has already consumed the next input token as an identifier, and then there's another identifier over there, well, we then run into a problem at that point. So the problem here is that parser state is reached by using one token look ahead in most cases, or even more token look ahead. So in cases that we have a one token look ahead, or at least a one token look ahead, then we run into a problem here. Yeah, because then the whole thing is an identifier. So, can you imagine of a solution for that dilemma? Well, of course, there's always the idea of trying to fix the look ahead inside the parser. However, this is very difficult to decide whether that is actually the right thing, because you have already made a decision based on the thing that you have read into your look ahead, and afterwards you would decide on the thing that you have read that this has to be a different thing. So this decision that you have to reduce in case of a declaration production, well, that has been a decision that was probably not correct, or it is debatable whether this reduction is actually reached when the next input symbol is a plain identifier. So, yeah, whether this is really the solution to that problem, that's I think it's pretty hard to get that correct. The next idea would be to say, well, screw it. Type names and identifiers are the same lexical things anyway, so let's add a new production that says that type names are actually identifiers. However, you already see the highlight here. You can do that, but if you do that for C, for example, you get a whole lot of shift reduce and reduce reduce conflicts, because especially these situations where you have several of these identifiers one after each other, and probably things like this, then there are situations where it is just not unique anymore. Which of the possibilities you mean? I certainly didn't get this example correct now, but anyway, there's examples which you can construct where you have different identifiers involved that might turn out to be cast, and in other cases probably function calls or something. So there's a lot of trouble you run into if you add this kind of rule to the grammar, so that's probably also not a good idea. So what remains left to do? Well, one of the ideas is to register the type name even earlier. I've told you before that the way these parser generators actually work is would be that as soon as you decide to accept this thing as a complete right-hand side, you would reduce, and in these cases you would have the chance to specify callback code. However, in practical systems, you also have other choices. You can add your action code pretty much between all of the symbols that you use on the right-hand side, so that the action table in the parser is added with new actions that correspond only to your callback and a shift instruction for continuing with the parse. So in these cases, for example, you can do a trick and register your callback between the declarator and the semicolon part. And in these cases, well, the semicolon won't change just because I register a new identifier in my declaration. And so it can be safely read in as a look ahead. I can perform my action, and when I do my shift action, I will just use my old look ahead, which is the semicolon, and then just then I will issue my call to the scanner, which will then produce a token which is based on my changes that I did on the list of type names. So in these cases, I can well, this is done with a separate rule. I think that's the equivalent solution. Anyway, this case is that actually works. At least for situations where you have a look ahead of one, because the semicolon is just considered to be one token. So in case you would like to parse your C code with a larger look ahead, well, that would be something that would lead into problems with these type names if you would apply this look ahead globally on your complete on your complete parsing, on your complete grammar and produce parser. There's parser generators out there which are more flexible, which kind of on the fly generate longer look aheads where they are actually needed, and those things could be configured in a way that you could restrict in this situation the look ahead to just length of one and enlarge it afterwards again. But I think that leads a little bit too far. Was it? Okay. Good. So much about special type-related declaration use association problems. Let's now continue with the application for our bindings, which is, for our purposes here, type checking. We have talked about the type inference already, but that's, I think, that's a topic that should be covered in the introduction to functional languages, where you probably will have had a lengthy section on type inference anyway. Anyway, type checking. How is that performed, and what is it actually good for? Well, the goal for type checking is pretty simple. For once, there's this concept of keeping apart different variables by with the intention to use them in a different way. For example, you would have to treat something like an integer different from a structure type, where you have different accesses for its components. And of course, you need to manage both of these concepts in with a different amount of memory, for example. So memory management is one of the goals for type checking, and also trying to access with accessor X in a plain integer will probably just not make any sense and produce random garbage if you let it run without yielding any errors. So in order to avoid runtime errors, you probably also want to have your types checked in advance. Okay. For languages like the ones that we had all the time as examples, C or Java or C++, which are imperative or object-oriented programming languages, in each of these languages you have this concept of declaring your types before using them, and the compiler would then check all the expressions that are made up from variables, whether you used them in the right way, and even try to infer the types for these overloaded operations. Yeah, types themselves are organized as kind of type expressions. So what you have is you have the kind of terminals of your type expression grammar, which is these the base types. That's integers, characters, floats, void, all these classical base names that you are already used to. You can also add to this list with the means that we have seen, so type deft, identifiers also go into this set of basic types. And then there's the second component of type expressions, which are the type constructors. That's are things that can be applied to other types to make them more complex types. For example, if you have a look at type constructors in C, there's the type constructor for the structure. Well, that's used the way that you start with the keyword struct, and then you open a new scope, and in this scope you perform a lot of declarations, and they are all kind of bundled together in order to form such a record and can be accessed with the identifiers that you gave there as names for the internal declarations. That was probably already the most complex one. There's also pointers. Pointers can be constructed with just star. Then there's arrays. Array types are constructed with the square brackets. And in certain cases, you can mention the maximal slots that fit into your array, so the number of fields of your array can be specified in some instances of the C language, and others you leave them away. And yeah, it depends on the standard that you have for C, whether which of the ones you can actually use. Then there's the type constructors for functions, for those you would start with the return type and then continue with ordinary brackets and have the types of the parameters in the brackets. Okay. Yeah. If you consider more complex programming languages, like, for example, what do we take? C or C sharp or Java, then there's also the concept of these second order types. So type expressions there can also have variables that can be replaced with types, and you can have second order type expressions in these. So, yeah, but that's something which is not covered in these more simpler type systems. So, for example, what can you do with types in C? Yeah, you can also have you can also associate certain complex types with just one type name, and for that you use this type def keyword. Yeah, this can be just used as an abbreviation. You've seen me doing that already on the slides beforehand. So there's the basic type. Well, that's probably too much. So the basic type you find in here, which is this structure, and you define it as a certain type with your type def, and afterwards you introduce the name with which you want to access this type afterwards. Well, you can use that in order to make your code more pretty. Consider the example over there, where you have a recursive data structure, where you have this structured list pointer And the thing that makes it not as pretty as the other version is that you always have to explicitly take several words in order to define that. You have another struct and another pointer, and you can make that more readable by just using these typedef things. So that's one thing how to make it more easy to read. So you would then only have to use the newly introduced type name, which is this list T. You can use it in all these places, and it just looks like an ordinary variable. You can go even further and add your own star in there and make it another name with a pointer in there, and then you could just have something that looks like an integer but is instead a pointer to a struct. And you can continue with type constructors in any way it pleases you with this thing. However, coming from the other side, as a compiler constructor, we have the duty to check these kind of expressions, and especially also the occurrences of the produced variables. So what we are given is at a certain program point. You have to imagine we are somewhere in the middle of a program, and we want to translate a new statement or a new instruction somehow, and we have to verify that this structure is not violating any typing rules. Then what we have is we are given a set of type declarations where we have a kind of an association of variable names and types, which is something that is kind of given by our symbol table. It's of course a little bit more difficult than just a plain list, but yeah, you know how to come up with these bindings from the last chapter. And the question is now, can an arbitrary expression E, which is something which is in most cases composed from several other expressions, can it be given a certain type T? Or even more general, is what is the most general type of that, the most specific type of that expression E? So what is the type for that? So that would be the problem of type checking. For example, let's assume that we have had a lot of declarations going on outside of method body somehow, and this is the situation that we came up with. So it's quite a mess, and the expression that we want to know which type we have to consider for this one is this one. So it's also quite a difficult one. So how can we do that? Well, the idea is to have this expression is given to us from the parser in a kind of hierarchical way. We know the structure for this expression, and as in most of the tree algorithms we have seen so far, we can quite easily already spot the locations where checking the type is probably quite simple. So if we just look at the leaves of our syntax tree, then for these things it's probably quite simple to check what the type for these things actually are. So probably the idea to type check the whole tree is to emanate from these locations and then go up the tree. So it's probably a bottom-up algorithm that we are going to do. For each of the identifiers, we will look up the corresponding type just in our type environment, and the constants, well, most of them already come from the scanner with a certain type. So for these, we have a fixed type. So the only question now is how we have to cope with the inner nodes and the inner nodes of the trees. are well, the only things we have to put work into, and how we do that is specified with typing rules. So that is something that leads us to type systems. What are these, the components of such a type systems? Well, there it's just a kind of set of these basic judgments here. We say that our type environment implies that an expression is of type T. So with these judgments, we can then introduce certain rules and axioms that are valid for our type system. And yeah, let's just start with type system for C. Well, in our case, we have certain fixed types, which are our constants. So whatever our type environment actually is, each constant gets its type from itself. So each of these constants already has a fixed type, so that's something which is not depending on the type environment. So we can just write its fixed type in there. Then for a variable, if our type environment is to be interpreted for a certain variable x, what we do is we actually just look into our symbol table in our map and just take what we get from this map as a type for the variable. So we just look up the type in our environment. So let's probably have a look at what typical rules in our system look like. These rules tell us about different kinds of expressions that can happen in our language and how these are interpreted type-wise. So there's a rule for the for performing reference operator on expressions. So what we have to, how we have to read these is, well, there's the part that tells us about preconditions. Then there's a part that tells us about what our actual expression looks like, and then there's a part that tells us how our new type actually looks like. So in this case, what are we looking at? Well, we are looking at the type expression like this one, which is the performing a reference operator on an expression, and it is typed in the type pointer to type T if T is the type that has been associated with E within our type environment so far. So that is how you have to read that. You have an expression, you have a precondition that binds some value to a variable, which is then used for giving us a new type. So we can have the same thing for our dereferentiation. So in this case, with the star operator in front of an expression, and this has to be typed with T in case that E, the type for E, is associated with a pointer to T in our environment. Yeah. And that's a very compact way of specifying all these things that are necessary for typing. So we introduce a lot more of these rules for our different situations that we end up in. You're already trying to parse all that. It's probably just try to do that one after the other. So for array access, we have two rules. Let's probably have a look at this. Yes, there's two array accesses. So we have two rules for that. So let's probably just start with the first one. So would you like to just start with the first one?
Yeah, I think the
So the type for the whole thing will be T afterwards. And how do we get this T? Exactly, so this T is bound over here. So this means that we can get this T if we look E1 up in our environment. Where do we get E1 from? Well, we have to look again in our original expression. So E1 is the thing before our array access. So from that, we get the type T pointer. And this T is the one is the type of the whole thing afterwards, of the whole access. But we don't. We still have to consider one thing. This only works if the type of E2, which is the index, is actually an integer. So that's another necessary precondition. Okay, so that's how you have to read these things. Let's probably continue with the next one, which is not that different. Once again, we have an array access. And, yeah, probably you want to help me with the thing? Mm-hmm. So if E1 is an array type, yes. So to say. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So needs to be an integer. Exactly. So they only differ in the way that we have a choice for the type of E1. It can either be a pointer type or an array type. In both cases, the whole system works. E2 always has to be an integer for the whole thing to work. Okay, if what actually happens if we cannot find valid or we cannot match our array expression with that because we cannot really fulfill, for example, this precondition?
We can try implicit casting.
If we need an integer,
we can try, okay, can we cast this expression E2 implicitly to an integer?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And if also that isn't possible? Typed error, exactly. So if you cannot match any of our rules here, we will get type error in these cases. Okay, nice. So, yeah, probably the struct. Let's have a look at the struct.
For the structure type, we will get the type TI.
Mm-hmm. So this one? Mm-hmm.
Is a structure type.
Yes.
And some of the one of the structure members.
Actually. Mm-hmm.
Or that member that is accessed, the element that is accessed as AI. That's the resulting in the type of the access.
There must exist some accessor in this struct type, and the corresponding. Type that corresponds to this accessor here will be the one that will generate our return type. Fine. So let's have a look at the next one. That's the application of a function. That's a large one now. Okay. So probably what is this good for? Mm-hmm.
So in order to infer to check that of the return type of the function.
Yes. In the end, we will use that for the return type. That's correct. So if we look up this name in the environment, we will get this thing that we will afterwards use as return type. Mm-hmm. Correct. But there's still more to that. Yeah, because we still need to treat the whole thing a little bit like a precondition. So there's necessary conditions for the whole thing to hold. And yeah, we have to look pretty close to get them. For example, you have an M and here an M. So one thing that you need is that they are defined with the same number of parameters.
Yep.
And it also turns up here. Well, you have the types of the parameters. You get them from the parameter list over here. So these go here. And what you need to do is you need to check with the actual types. So if you have your actual parameters over here, you need to also need to look them up in the environment, whether their type matches the types that are entered in the type that you get for the function name. Okay, so it's a pretty complex rule. Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it be possible to implement variable arguments list at this level?
You probably need to patch a lot, but I think so, but yeah. There's, for example, well, what would you have to do? Well, we talked about the fixed number here, which is not the same thing anymore. And also, I think our variable argument functions really type checked. That's what I would have expected. So, as far as I remember from C, you have some kind of macros that do your unpacking of your.
Yes, exactly. So, normally, yeah. It's a model of my pseudo arguments that expands to several arguments.
Yeah. I think also that this is more on the semantic side, because, well, that's a well-known example, especially for the printf. But I think for the other, if you do it in a user-defined function, I don't think that there's any warning coming with that. But yeah, what you can do at least is for the fraction of your parameters that's not actually captured with the variable argument part, then for these you can do the checking. Yeah, but you probably have to introduce a new application rule. Also, I think what we have here is that we enforce that the application actually uses the same number of parameters in its actual parameters than the formal parameters of function specification specify. However, I think in practical languages, if you really talk about C, then at least in the older standards, you could call a method or a function with an arbitrary number of parameters, as long as it is it has more actual parameters, or at least as many actual parameters as there's formulas in your specified method. So, yeah. But that's probably the dirt that you get in your system if you work with these kind of legacy systems like C, which has been used for a whole lot of time before they even started about thinking formal grammars and more kind of a drawing board solution like Java or C#. Okay. Well, that raised a lot of discussion. Yeah. So then there's the typing rule for operators. So I think that's a treat now. For anyone, after you've done all the difficult work. So I think that's not so difficult here. You will probably hard code a lot of the work here, because, well, for example, the addition evaluates to type int if both of the operands have been integers. Yeah, that's not so difficult to read. And yeah, then there's casts, where we break with our formal system here a little bit with the text, because we didn't introduce this concept so far, but we need it already for our type system. So yeah, the casts are expression E is casted to a type T2, and this will result in type 2 if, well, something can be converted in exactly the type that we say here. And what is this something? Well, that is the thing that we look up for E in our environment. So if the type that we look up for E can be converted to T2, then the whole thing can be has the type that we given it. So yeah, this notion of can be converted is a little bit imprecise here. There's a concept of something like one type is assignable to another, and that's something that we haven't yet introduced here. So that's something that we would need here, and that's a property of two types that you can also define and bring into your type system. But yeah, that's not as far as we go here. Is there any what?
Is there any rule or restriction to convert type T1 to type T2 in the real programming language? So I'm not completely sure, but I think you can convert.
Can you directly cast between one function signature and another?
I think in C you can. The compiler just does it, and weird things happen afterwards. But I think in other languages like Java or something like that, it is not allowed. They always do proper type checking and check if it's really a good idea to do what you try to do.
So maybe this can be converted test in C is more of a nice name, but there's nothing so complex. I don't remember. It has been quite a long time since I've written my last C compiler, so that's probably pretty. It's probably pretty simple what was actually done there. But for other languages, there's this concept of one type can be assigned to another type, and that's what should be there in these cases. Okay. Yeah, so we can perform one of these type checks on the example that we've done so far. So let's probably start with just annotating the types. So maybe you want to start telling me what's, well, that's probably clear. That's an integer. I don't know why the C is in blue.
I think it's
it's an
name.
It's an accessor, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that doesn't have a type yet. So B probably. What is B?
Yeah. Yeah, you have to look it up.
That's the environment.
Yeah.
And B is here. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so what B is it's a struct with a little bit of complex in the middle and a pointer. So it's a pointer to a struct. Okay, so probably let's just, yeah?
Just go on with the, yeah, with F. Okay, F is a function that returns an int, and yeah.
So we have an int, and it gives a struct lists. Now I'm running out of space, but yeah, so much about that. Then A, that's also not so difficult. A is just int pointer array. Okay. So, next part. What do I have to do now?
Yes.
No, the leaves have been done by your neighbor. You can choose anyone. The scheduling is up to you. So discussing which of the nodes you're doing now?
I'm not sure what I should do.
Well, what you would do is you would search for the, well, yeah, this one's is a leaf, but it's a special leaf, so we'll probably leave it out. But
I think the star means I have to make a point to not a point anymore, or it should be like this.
We would probably need to look at the at how our type system actually deals with these pointer nodes. So try to memorize all the types. Or, well, that's your task, I think. And let's have a look at what this thing was about. Yeah. So this is how we have to treat our thing. So that is the expression. Exactly. So that's how we treat this thing. It's probably a little bit unsuited to have. Yeah, sorry about that. I should probably do that a little bit different. But anyway, what you would do is.
Okay, then I take the type of B, what is structure.
Mm-hmm. B was this. Yeah, and it's now a struct with a lot of things inside without a pointer. And this has been the pointer before. So.
And the dot refers to the list, to the C, and that's the pointer.
Mm-hmm. So now that we know the type of the left operand, we can do something with the right operand. And I can show you once again the necessary thing. Because that's a little bit mean afterwards. So this is the thing that we want to interpret now. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So the type ty, that's some type of which is relevant to this one. Okay. So we will probably have. I removed that. But what the only thing that we can look up is C anyway, and that's C here. And it was exactly that type that we had. So what we have here now is the type of C, and that is struct list pointer.
So it's a pointer to a struct with this list, or
pointer to a to the list struct. Yes. Okay. Whew. Done. But that was probably the first difficult thing. Okay. So you want to continue probably.
Function application, I guess it gets quite easy now because the type of that is integer. We pass in something of the type struct this function, oh. And now we get the type that we defined before, so it's integer.
Yeah, I did boo-boo there. So we have struct list, and struct list is a parameter. And if we look back, we will see that we have to match the parameters. We only have one parameter. It is matched, as you say. And what we can take away is that this is the return type. So this will be our type here, which is fortunate because next thing that we are going to look at is an array access. And what we had as precondition is that the index must be an integer. Woo, nice. So for A is an integer pointer array. Ah. Exactly. So just removes the braces and creates integer pointer. Gets even easier. Now what is it's not so easy. Integer pointer has been here, and yeah, I'll review. Okay, now everything I think is pretty clear. We have an integer and an integer and plus, and its integer is the type for the whole thing. So, fine. It type checks and it produces an integer. Nice. Okay. And I could have just skipped to the next page. Good. That's for the type checking, at least in the first place. So what we have to look at is the child nodes of our expressions. We have to match them with the preconditions and the type of expressions in our rules, and from that we can piece by piece fiddle out which of the types is actually the ones for our global type for this part of the syntax tree. Okay. In order to do so, we need some kind of concept to talk about equality of types. And as far as C goes, type equality is something which is considered to be by name. So this is specifically talking about this concept of structures. If you imagine that you could, for example, have a structure A that has nothing inside and a structure B, then in principle you could say, well, that's essentially the same structure. However, in C, this is name-based, and if you use name A and name B here, so that is results in a situation like this, then the C system will consider both of these structs to be different because they're actually named different. So in C, type equality is something which is not considered to be a structural property, but a property of correct naming. This is probably to do with the fact that C does a lot of bit fiddling, and it optimizes a lot in the layout of the data structures, so it would by default try to reorder the sequence of fields that are, or accessors that are inside of these structures. And you cannot rely in every case that the compiler would have done that in the same way for another structure that looks to be the same one, so you might end up in problems if you would do these type checks in C on a structural way. However, you could imagine that systems exist that do their type equality in a more structural way. Well, there's even a name for that, which is this kind of duck typing, where you say that two of these data structures do behave in the same way, then they are considered to be the same. With ducks, you would say if it quacks, then it's probably a duck. So that's structural equality. That's something that what we do not have in C, but we could imagine a language pretty similar to C, which would support something like that. And we could have a look at how type systems do actually differ if we introduce something like that. So, for that, we would probably need an alternative interpretation of this whole thing. So, just keep in mind that this is something which does not hold in C. However, it's not... it's nothing bad to think about something like that, because that might happen to you in some other language. So, on a kind of semantical basis, if we talk about structural equality, then two types would be considered to be equal if you have a look at the access paths that you have from both of these types, and if all the access paths are actually the same, then you would consider two of these types to be the same. semantically sent. So, for example, let's have a look at the code that we see down there, where we have, this is still C syntax, but not valid C in the sense that those things are actually equal in a standard C, but in a structurally equivalence based type system, they would be. Why is that? We have the first structure list that has just an info element and a next pointer, which points to another list. And then let's have a look at another structure, which is list one, which also has a data entry in there. And then it has another struct pointer, which is also called next, and it points to a structure which has an info pointer and another pointer next, which points to the original type, list one. So, if we look at them, then both of them are allowing similar accesses to its elements than they would have. No, not like this. They would allow to perform lookup of info, and they would allow to look up or have an access path of next and then info. So both of them could be considered to be quite similar from a semantic point of view if you just have a look at the access paths. So how can we come up with a more with a nice method for thinking about structural equality of two type expressions? Well, the idea would be to track a set of equivalence queries of type expressions and try to simplify them to hopefully smaller type expressions. And if we come to base types, we will be able to stop. And if we come to a type expression that we have already tried to track so far, we will probably have come to a recursive type declaration. This will be also something where we can just stop. So that's something that we should probably look at by example. So just one preliminary standard that we set. To make things more simple, we will use in our type specifications now these green letters, which are kind of templates for other types. We will use them if we have to specify recursive types. Is that? Yeah. Okay. So, for example, the rules for well-typedness in these structurally equivalence-based type systems are like that. You would always have two types that you want to compare, and you would try to deduce simpler type expressions to compare with each other. This looks like this, the very simple example from over here, where you have two types T. And if they are both the same, so both have T in there, you would not continue anymore because you have already found the same types. So this is the thing for base types. If T is a base type, then you don't have to continue. You already have two types that are just the same. If you have pointer types, S and T, when you do structural comparison, you only need to show that S and T are structurally equivalent. When you have a type T and a named type A, then all you need to do is you need to replace the template A with the actual type S. So you will have to compare S and T with each other for equivalence. Then there's the structs, and that's where the structural equivalence actually comes from. In standard C, we would have compared the names C and D of the structs, but in our case, we're not talking about named structures anymore, but just the structure of the structs. And in these cases, all we have, well, what we have to do is now we have to put more work in the whole thing because we have to make sure that all the fields of the structs that have the same accessor do also have structurally equivalent types. So we also do so for the accessor AM. So we will probably also do labels for the edges here. And yeah, so we have to match the different accessors for their types, and that's how we can do our structural equivalence tests. So, for example, we have one type specification which we call A. So the first template is A, and the associated type expression is a structure which has an info element and a next pointer. And then we have another type B, which is a bit more complex. It has an inner structure, which we access on the next, and it has an info field. So that's the same example that we had before. We had all the deduction rules. So what we want to know is whether this type expression is actually structurally equivalent to what our template B gives us. So for that, we would have to come up with a tree of deductions that conforms to our deduction rules. So what would be the first thing that we would have to check? Well, the first thing is that for such a template B, when it is used in such a deduction, we have to replace it with its associated type. So at the left side, we have this pretty complex struct that we had up there. And for B, we have, this. So this is also a struct, and it is this struct. So if we have two structs, what we have to do now is we have to match accessors. So as this one has two accessors, we will have one accessor info and one accessor next. For the left side, we will have, for info, we will have int. It's good. For the right side, which has been this B, we also find that there's an info accessor, which also says int. That's fine. That's something that where we can say that's structurally equivalent. So we only have to follow the second part. Here we also have to compare two variants for next. The first next thing is comes from here, which is a pointer to A, and from here, which is a pointer to lengthy struct. That is, in principle, this one. And we have to continue with our deduction steps. But I run out of space here, so I just turn the page, and magically everything fits together. where we have left off was probably here. This is where we had the pointer to A, and on the other side we had a pointer to this dot, 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 which was the struct over here. Okay, so to go on, what we have to do is, we have to, at first we just write or insert what we have left out with this dot, 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 which was the struct over there. And then for this deduction step, we follow the rule that if you have a template on one side, we have to replace it. So that's what we're doing. And template A goes to struct with slot info and slot next. And now we once again have to match our accessors. There's one accessor with info and one accessor with next. Info gives us once again integers. That's fine. So we can terminate this deduction over here. And for the other side, we will have to consider what we can reach with the accessor next. And what we can reach there is once pointed to B and once pointed to A. And we have to remove the pointers on both sides. So we're reaching here. And we will have A and B. So we have to perform replacement of one of the templates. So we could continue quite a lot of times here, but turns out that if we replace either one of them, for example the left one, we will reach a comparison that we have already done before, which was this one. So we have a kind of recursively called structural matching, and so we can terminate at that point. We could also have replaced B with its respective content. Then we would have found that this one has already been compared. So that's also sufficient. So if at any point in our deduction tree we reach a comparison that we have done before, we will have reached a point where recursion of these data structures is happening. So we can just say, well, we have found that thing already in the past, and we can just terminate at that point. So the idea would be if we do that by hand, would be that we would try to strategically reach these nodes that we already have had somewhere in the past. So repetition is a good thing here. Anyway, what will be the case is if we implement that, we don't have to fear that the whole system won't terminate, because, well, all we can do is we can in these nodes we can just compare all the declared types from a set D, which is a finite set, and we only can do pairs of elements from this thing. So there's a natural bound for how many of these queries we can actually have in our tree, and since a repeated query is something where we say that the deduction is automatically satisfied, then the whole algorithm would definitely terminate at some point. So that's how we can do our structural comparison. So I think that's something that I will leave for next time, which is overloading and coercion, which will be some kind of refinement of the structural comparison of two types. But I think we need a little bit more time than that. So I thank you for today and wish you a nice week, and hope we see us on next Monday. Goodbye.